It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. We're glad you're back. I'm Mark Bayshore. Coming up on today's program, we've got live music from WKAR Studio S. Vocalist Molly McFadden and pianist Mike Brush join us a little bit later on this hour. Molly's the founder and chair of the organization Michigan Jazz Trail. So we'll hear from Molly and Mike, and we'll hear about what the Michigan Jazz Trail is all about and what they're up to. MSU's Dr. Charlie Ballard joins us shortly with the results of the latest State of the State survey. Also later this hour, some state legislators are joining others from around the country to explore the chances of a national constitutional convention. We'll find out why in the second half of the program. But first, as no doubt of most of you are well aware, Nelson Mandela died yesterday at the age of 95. For the anti-apartheid leader, Michigan was a special place. And Current State's Joe Lindstroth is here to tell us more. Hi, Joe.
Well, hello, Mark. That's right. Michigan really was a national leader in the anti-apartheid movement. It was the first state to divest from South Africa. The late Michigan Congressman Howard Wolpe led the national effort to impose sanctions on the white minority government, overcoming two vetoes by then-President Ronald Reagan. But Michigan's leadership in America's anti-apartheid movement actually began here at Michigan State University. MSU was the first public university, to divest from South Africa. In 1979, the university sold $8.5 million worth of stock in 13 companies, and that wasn't without some backlash. Mm-hmm. There are some pretty powerful Michigan companies who did have investments in South Africa, GM, Ford, Dow Chemical among them. Earlier this morning, I spoke with Kurt Dewhurst. He's the Director of Arts and Culture Initiatives here at MSU, and he led the university's collaboration with the Nelson Mandela Museum in South Africa, where he spent extensive time. He explained how the movement to divest in South Africa started on the MSU campus back in the late 70s.
With the leadership of a core group of faculty and staff and community members and governmental figures started to join what was an emerging set of sanctions to move toward putting some economic pressure on the apartheid government, and MSU Board of Trustees voted to divest of its stock interests and corporations working and having presence in South Africa. And then not too long after, in the next couple of years, they helped push through the state of Michigan doing the same thing. And Michigan became one of the first states in the United States also to add pressure and economic sanctions that really helped provide outside pressure on the apartheid government that continued to grow and eventually, of course, led to the end of apartheid in 1993.
Talk to me about some of the challenges this effort faced, both on campus at MSU and I think more broadly in the state of Michigan. There were some pretty big Michigan companies, Ford, GM, Dow Chemical, that had investments in South Africa. What sort of opposition did this movement face?
You know, I think for me, people who lived through that period of time, who were not aware of really what was going on in South Africa, they were surprised to see these kinds of actions happening. And in fact, figured that somehow that they really wouldn't have the impact that they did. And so, you know, it was a courageous step for the university, I think, to support the efforts for a democratic new South Africa, because the university clearly lost financial support from some of those corporations who questioned that decision. Over time, I think, as people look back on it, they knew that MSU was on the right side of this of history, and it was a wise thing to do and one for the state of Michigan. And, of course, in the end, we look back now and we celebrate the liberation struggle and the creation of a non-racial, free, democratic South Africa today.
On the national level, the late Michigan Representative Howard Wolpe co-authored legislation that imposed sanctions against South Africa in 1986, and he led two overrides of Ronald Reagan's vetoes of what became the Comprehensive Anti-Apartheid Act. How were Wolpe's efforts viewed by Nelson Mandela and the global anti-apartheid movement?
Well, I'm really happy you brought that up. Many people don't realize Howard Wolpe's influence, and he is very highly regarded in South Africa. it's always been interesting to me when I first started working there, how many people remember the Wolpe name who are part of the liberation struggle. He was indeed a national leader, and the Wolpe family as a whole were played a key role. And then even at the local level, we think about in Michigan, other connections, Lynn Jondal, who was a local representative and, of course, a former candidate for governor, was also part of a group of individuals and political leaders that stepped forward and really made a difference, both at the state and national level. So, I think there are significant connections. It's also, worth noting that, Michigan State has such a strong presence across the African continent. Many people are not aware that the African Studies Center at MSU is the largest in the U.S.
It's the largest,
190 faculty working on the African continent. And for many years, very strong ties in South Africa. And as a result of that, today we have a variety of different connections and ties there. We have through the MSU Museum, we have a formal partnership with the Nelson Mandela Museum, and a program that was started to honor Mr. Mandela is a MSU Museum, Mandela Museum Graduate Curatorial Fellowship that we have, I think it's 7 study abroad programs now in South Africa. Wow. MSU over the years has produced probably more PhDs of African students who've come to study at Michigan State and returned to their countries. And, of course, most recently, the MasterCard Scholars Program that's supporting undergraduate and graduate students to have experiences as earned degrees at Michigan State, another example of the ongoing set of connections. And I think some people probably would say, well, Mr. Mandela has passed, some of these relationships may not continue, but I think quite the opposite. I think they will continue to grow his legacy that these all honor, and we'll ensure that there's a strong presence of MSU as well as with the many faculty members who work in South Africa who continue to do great work there.
How important was Michigan in the global anti-apartheid movement? Put it in perspective for us.
I think for many those of us who live in Michigan or have connections certainly to MSU, I think we could take a real sense of pride in that. I think the strong connections with the civil rights movement in our state also had a way of connecting. I was working on an exhibition we did for Mr. Mandela's 90th birthday called Dear Mr. Mandela, Dear Mrs. Parks, all focusing on children's letters written to the two of them that we mounted at the National Museum in South Africa. And I was doing research and discovered the photographs of and the documentation of when Mr. Mandela came to Detroit on his first U.S. tour. And I knew that in reading about his life that he had always talked about how he admired Rosa Parks. And there's this great image of him that was on the front page of Detroit newspapers at the time of him coming off the plane. And the first words out of his mouth is, "Where's Rosa Parks? I want to meet Rosa Parks." And, of course, she was there. And it's just an indication of his connection, even in prison, to the presence of people like Rosa Parks here in Michigan, who he admired. And I know in his opening speech, he even referred to them. He had a great interest in Motown music that he followed while in prison. And he even quoted Marvin Gaye. Yeah.
The words go, quote, "Brother, brother, there's far too many of you dying."
There's some natural connections here with Michigan, and ones that I hope that we'll all take some time to give more thought to as we think about a man who was certainly one of the most important figures of the 20th century. And what those lessons are for the 21st century as we look ahead.
In thinking about this, your business is history and preserving what was valuable in the past. Professor Dewhurst, what qualities do you feel Nelson Mandela had that we need to preserve and remember?
Well, you know, probably the thing that that strikes me, of course, is the path that he chose to take. You know, he really, as we all think about the 21st century, his ability to reach out and connect with people who you don't see the world in the same way with, and get to know them and try to understand what their qualities are and where you can find common ground. I mean, he was a successful politician, I suppose you can argue, and skillful negotiator, because he partially disarmed people of his sincere interest in getting to know them and trying to understand them and understand why they were different. But he didn't let that difference separate them. When he comes out of prison and then is elected president, what is the first thing he's focusing on is the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Rather than revenge or vengeance guiding him, it was about unity. And I think one of the things he always sought was strength and unity. And he understood that that was necessary for South Africa, certainly economically, but also, I think, at the very base human level, that he needed to bring people together. I think that Mr. Mandela clearly is somebody that we will continue to learn from, and his legacy will guide us, I hope, in the 21st century.
Kurt Dewhurst is Director of Arts and Culture Initiatives at MSU and a curator at the MSU Museum. He led the university's collaboration with the Nelson Mandela Museum in South Africa and has extensive experience working there. Thank you, Professor Dewhurst, for helping us remember Michigan's connection to Nelson Mandela.
Thank you. Nice to be with you this morning.
It's not the pale moon that excites me, the thrills and delights me. Oh no, it's just the nearness of you. Conversation that brings me this sensation. Oh no, it's just the nearness of you. When you're in my arms.
Singer Molly McFadden, live from WKAR's Studio S. She's accompanied on keyboard by Mike Brush. Molly is the founder and the chair of the organization Michigan Jazz Trail, busy promoting Michigan jazz, and we'll talk with Molly and Mike here in just a few minutes and hear them perform again later this hour on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. President Obama's approval rating in Michigan has dropped to its lowest point in 3 years, according to a new Michigan State University survey. That's one of various interesting findings in MSU's latest State of the State survey released yesterday. The telephone survey, which sampled almost 1,000 Michigan adults between August and October, also updated approval ratings for Governor Rick Snyder and asked the public how it feels about its economic future. Here to review some of the findings, Director of the State of the State survey, we welcome back Dr. Charlie Ballard.
Glad to be with you, Mark.
Good to see you, Charlie. Give us the numbers on President Obama, then. This is the lowest point in approval ratings since 2010.
That's right. We ask people their opinion about the president and the governor, and we give them four choices: excellent, good, fair, and poor. And the positives are the excellent or good. So we put those together, and this time he had 38.3% in either the excellent or good category. That's down from, in most of his administration, he's been in the 40s. He actually had a bump up last winter when he was inaugurated. He was at 48, and then he's fallen in two consecutive surveys. I attributed it, at least in part, to the trouble with the bumpy rollout of healthcare.gov. This was a survey that straddled that rollout, and in September before that, he was in the low 40s, 41. 31.4%, but then dropped to 34% in October. So the combined, the average of those two parts of the survey came out to about 38% positive.
Now, do you infer the reasons for his decline in popularity, or when someone registers disapproval with the president, do you ask specifically why?
No, this is just my opinion, just my inference. We don't do a lot of follow-up questions.
Okay. Now, a bigger than average drop, I see, also in approval from the beginning of the survey to the end of the survey. Meaning what?
Well, we are in the field for several weeks, just because it takes a lot of time to get a comprehensive survey of this type, where we ask hundreds of questions, not just the president and the governor, but lots and lots of questions.
That many?
Okay. And to get 1,000 completed interviews, it takes a long time because,
sure,
you know, you got people who don't answer the phone. So we were in the field for several weeks, and before October 1st, his numbers were somewhat better, and then they fell. And my interpretation is it's a combination of a reaction to the troubles with the healthcare website and also a reaction to the government shutdown, which, of course, the government shutdown is not entirely the president's fault, but it shows up in lower numbers both for the president and for the Congress in other surveys.
For a little perspective, what was President Obama's highest rating, and when was that?
It was right after he took office. And in fact, that is a common theme for both Obama, Snyder, and Granholm. The highest rating that they ever had was in the very first survey that we took after they took office. He was at 71% favorable back in the winter of 2009. That's sort of a new kid on the block phenomenon, the honeymoon that goes with the excitement that goes with a new leader. But inevitably, honeymoons wear off. And in fact, for President Bush and for Governor Engler and Governor Granholm, the lowest ratings in their time was the last one before they left office. We sort of kick them in the butt as they're going out the door.
If we could just get everybody to serve for 6 months, you realize how great everything would be?
That's right.
Just 6 month terms of office and we're all set. Now, is that a pretty typical range? 70? 70 is pretty high.
No, that was sky high. For instance, Rick Snyder's, the highest in his administration was his very first time in office, but only at 44.5%. Jennifer Granholm's, her highest was her first time after she came to office, but only at 58%. So Obama's high was unusually high, but then that means that he fell quite a ways to sort of settle in the low 40s and now in the upper 30s.
Let's move on to Governor Rick Snyder. How have Michiganians felt about the governor lately?
Well, he's been for the last 2 years mostly in the low to mid-30s, so a little bit below what President Obama has been. He took a little bit of a dip to just under 30% back in our survey earlier this year in the spring, but now he's rebounded to 35.6%, and that's really consistent with where he's been for most of his time in office. So not spectacular approval ratings, but I would note that at the same point in her administration, the fall of the third year, Jennifer Granholm was at almost exactly the same number where Rick Snyder is now.
How about that? And how do you infer the bump, this as modest as it is, in Governor Snyder's approval rating?
You know, there's a lot of potential explanations for that. One is, I think there may have been some irritation at some of the things that happened last December. The way in which the right to work law was pushed through after the governor had said that it was off the table, and then it suddenly was on the table. So his ratings dropped a little bit in the early surveys of 2013, but then perhaps that irritation has worn off. But it's not a huge change in any event.
Mm-hmm.
From just under 30 to 36, that's not much bigger than the margin of error for the survey.
We're talking with Dr. Charlie Ballard, who's the director of the quarterly State of the State survey. Now, since Governor Granholm was reelected with that rather weak approval rating, can we also infer that Rick Snyder then is similarly reelectable?
I think he's reelectable. Whether he will be reelected is of course, a huge question and depends on so many things that will happen in the next 11 months. But the experience with Granholm, in fact, her numbers continued to fall in 2006, down to the low 30s, but she was reelected. Now, I think that's partly because Dick DeVos did not run a terribly effective campaign against her.
It really depends on the dynamic of the opponent, really, to a large extent.
Absolutely. And Mark Schauer is the presumptive Democratic nominee to face off against Governor Snyder. I think it's fair to say right now that most Michigan residents don't know Mark Schauer very well. If they know him at all, they will know him by next November, and we'll see what they say.
Speaking of these relatively modest approval ratings, your survey launched almost 20 years ago. Over the years, have you determined what level of approval is required for an incumbent governor to have a realistic chance at re-election? I mean, if you were a betting man, would an incumbent governor with, say, a 25% approval rating effectively be out of it? Has a pattern like that emerged?
Well, we only have elections every so often, and I think, honestly, 25% approval would be, it might be hard to get reelected with that. But we've seen from Granholm's reelection in 2006 that it is possible to have pretty modest numbers and still be reelected. As you said, much depends upon how the electorate evaluates not just the person who's in office, but who's running against them. And I think if Mark Schauer runs an effective campaign, he may be a tough opponent. That remains to be seen. I think certainly it's likely that the election in 2014 will not be the cakewalk that 2010 was.
Okay. You also inquired about how Michiganians feel about the economy. What did you learn?
Well, taking a historical perspective, we ask, how is your current financial situation? How are you relative to a year ago? How do you think you're going to be a year from now? And all of those were very, very good numbers back in the late 90s, which is maybe not surprising because, remember, our unemployment rate in Michigan was below 4% in the late 90s.
Yeah.
Then they fell throughout the very difficult first decade of the 21st century, and they bottomed out in 2009. And then they rebounded, but now it seems like that rebound has sort of run out of steam because the numbers have been pretty flat for the last couple of years. We have about half of the population, almost exactly half, saying that their current financial situation is excellent or good. That's a little bit down from our previous survey, but it's substantially up from 2009. On the other hand, it's way below what it was in 1999.
Very good. Dr. Charlie Ballard is director of the State of the State Survey here at Michigan State University. Charlie, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know, where the treetops glisten, children listen to hear sleigh bells in the snow. I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, with every Christmas card I write, days be merry.
Well, the holiday season has officially begun here on Current State. Thanks to Molly McFadden and Mike Brush, our live performers here today on WKAR's Current State, coming to you live here from Studio S at WKAR. We'll talk with Molly and Mike here in just a little bit and hear them perform again as well. On Saturday, state lawmakers from around the country will meet at Mount Vernon to discuss how they can push for a new constitutional convention. Their primary goal is to pass and ratify an amendment to the U.S. Constitution requiring a balanced federal budget. Current State Scott Pohl has a Michigan perspective on the effort to enact a balanced budget amendment.
State Senator Mike Green is a Republican who represents the 31st District in Aranac, Bay, Huron, Sanilac, and Tuscola counties. Most Americans are familiar with amending the Constitution with passage by two-thirds votes in both houses of Congress, followed by ratification by three-fourths of the states. Senator Green tells me that the Mount Vernon Assembly is being held to discuss the other way the Constitution can be amended under Article 5. It provides for a way that state legislatures can force Congress to call a constitutional convention.
Yeah, the process really is quite simple. Someone has to introduce a resolution in the House or the Senate, and both houses have to pass it on a majority record roll call vote, and then that goes to Congress. The message is sent that Michigan has passed it, and then once 34 states passes a resolution for a call to a convention, the convention will happen. Congress will designate a time and a place. The states will get together to proceed what the resolution calls to do.
And it's my understanding that once it comes to that, should an amendment be approved at such a convention, that then would still also have to be ratified by three-fourths of the states. Is that correct?
That's exactly correct, yes.
And you have introduced a resolution requiring a balanced budget amendment. It has passed the Senate. It awaits action in the House, right?
Exactly right there, too. It's a process that really is quite simple. Went to committee, voted out of committee, went to the, just like any bill would do. But in these instances, according to the Constitution, the governor does not play a role.
All right. Explain why you think a balanced budget amendment is a good idea.
Well, I don't have stats in front of me, but statistics over and over and over has shown that Congress is spending money like a drunken sailor, if I can use the term, without offending any sailors. But they're out of control. They seem to find a solution to every problem by throwing a lot of money at it. And it's not, of course, it's not their money. It's not even our money. It's borrowed money. And the process seems to get worse and worse every year. And it doesn't seem to matter which president is running the country, Republican or Democrat. They still spend money that they don't have, continue to increase the debt, and continue to leave major, major obligations to my kids and my grandkids. And it has to stop. And they have not shown any inclination to stop it. Now, this process, a balanced budget amendment, has been talked about a lot over the last number of years. It almost happened under President Reagan. And they were one state short of having a convention. But we really believe the movement across the nation, and it is a movement, will push this to a convention, and then it'll have to be ratified by the states.
What are you hearing about the state house and whether it's likely to approve your measure?
Yeah, they'll pass it. It's explained to me they're not in a big hurry to do it, but they're going to do it probably after the first of the year.
And it then goes to Congress. It bypasses the governor's office, right?
Absolutely. And Congress keeps track. Somebody in Congress, I'm not sure, but they keep track of what states have done it. And once that magic number is hit of 34, then that triggers them to call the convention.
Have other states already reached that point of passage in both houses of their legislature, with the exception, I assume, of one of the states has a unicameral legislature?
Yeah, right now 20 has passed it. We'll be the 21st. Now, as I mentioned, under when Ronald Reagan was president, it would have been in the 80s, they passed, 34 states had passed it. 33, they could never get to 34. Now, at that point, Michigan, Ohio, and Wisconsin were not ones on record passing it. But this time, we're all three going to pass it.
Now, state lawmakers from all over the country are getting together this weekend at Mount Vernon to talk about a constitutional convention. Is the balanced budget amendment the primary focus, do you know, of the people who are gathering at Mount Vernon? Are there other constitutional amendments that might be considered?
The balanced budget amendment is the main impetus for this discussion. But really, what we're getting together to do is to begin planning for the convention when it happens. Not if it happens, but when it happens. We'll be able to understand a little bit more about the process. Now, each state will send delegates, but they'll only have one vote of whether or not to accept language for the amendment. Most all of the resolutions states are passing are the same. Some may not be identical, but the majority of them will, and the main focus will be the balanced budget amendment. And I think that's probably all that will be discussed.
I brought it up because I wondered if there was any possibility or likelihood of this turning into something of a kettle of fish where more issues would be raised, perhaps things would get bogged down because the focus is dispersed. Is there any concern that that sort of thing might erupt at this meeting?
There is a lot of concern by people that don't want it to happen. And that is some of the discussion going on now by people that don't want a balanced budget amendment on our Constitution. They're trying to stir up, negatives towards passing the resolution by saying, oh, it'll turn into a runaway convention. It'll rewrite our whole convention, which isn't true. I mean, our whole Constitution, which isn't true at all, because you got to remember, after we pass this, and after we propose an amendment, 38 states have to pass it in order for it to become law, part of the Constitution.
Well, you've reflected on the likelihood of the number of states needed to call such a convention. Do you have a sense for whether there are 38 states out there that might ratify a balanced budget amendment?
Well, we're quite sure we'll get 34. And I'm not sure where the other four are going to come from. There is a leadership, a nationwide group that's doing, and they call it the Balanced Budget Amendment Task Force, comprised of legislators and non-legislators. And this task force is moving the states, getting them information, helping them pass it in committee. And they're the ones that's kind of overseeing the whole thing. They believe that there will be 38 states to do it. Now, you know, once it's recommended, the amendment, I don't believe there's a timeline that 38 states have to pass it by.
Would you know if any other Michigan lawmakers are going to this meeting at Mount Vernon?
I do know Representative Eric Nesbitt is going to be there.
We've mentioned that this approach bypasses the governor's office. Do you know whether the governor supports a balanced budget amendment or not?
I never got a direct statement from him saying, absolutely, yes, we do. I spoke with his chief of staff, and he alluded to one of his state of the state messages where he alluded to that, and that, yes, absolutely, he believes he would support it, but I never got anything directly from him. In fact, because we didn't need him, we really didn't go that direction. But we're convinced that he probably does because of his outlook on balancing budgets.
One would assume that this particular effort is made up primarily, maybe even exclusively, of Republicans. Have you heard from any of your Democratic colleagues about how they react not just to the notion of a balanced budget amendment, but the idea of calling a constitutional convention? What are Democrats telling you?
Well, in our Senate, all 12 of them voted no. There is a real feeling that if we have a balanced budget, we won't have a lot of pork to spend. So some people are concerned about that. Well, gee, how will we balance our budgets if we didn't get as much money from the federal government? Well, that was the way they argued on the floor in the Senate that, gee, we want to just keep the process going. And by saying that, they meant they want to keep borrowing and spending. But there has been other states with Democratic leadership, I believe, that has passed it. But I can't, I could, I probably could tell you a little bit more about that after I get back Saturday after that. 70% of Dem Senate caucus voted for it in Ohio. 70% of the Democratic caucus voted for it.
Is there any special significance to holding this meeting at Mount Vernon, the home of George Washington?
Well, George Washington was a part of the original Constitution forming it. And other than that, I'm not sure. It was a place, there's a couple of state legislative associations meeting in Washington this weekend, and that Washington would have been a good place for it. And I guess, as long as we're going to be in Washington, let's do it at Mount Vernon. So I'm going to assume that's the reason.
State Senator Mike Green is one of many legislators from around the country gathering at Mount Vernon this weekend to talk about a balanced budget amendment and calling a constitutional convention to make that happen. Thank you for talking with us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure, and we hope we get this thing done.
For Current State, this is Scott Powell.
I've got you under my skin. I've got you deep in the heart of me. So deep in my heart, you're really a part of me. I have got you under my skin. I tried so.
Singer Molly McFadden, pianist Mike Brush, live from WKAR Studio S here today on Current State. We'll visit with Molly and Mike and hear them perform again here in just a few minutes. I'm Mark Bayshore. You know, with the Michigan State-Ohio State showdown tomorrow night for the Big Ten Football Championship, I have to draw your attention to a photo that's making the rounds on social media. Have you seen the photo of the one stretch of urban Indianapolis with the sign, the road sign, pointing drivers to Ohio Street and Michigan Street? Of course, on the sign, street is abbreviated. Picture that. Work with me now. Yeah, right next to each other on the road sign. Ohio State, Michigan State. Perfect. Go Green. It's Current State on WKAR. This Sunday marks the second week of Advent, the start of the Christian church year and the prelude to Christmas. It's also the 100th anniversary of Lansing's Roman Catholic Cathedral, St. Mary's, and here to tell us more, Current State's Kevin Lavery. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Mark. The cathedral actually predates the founding of the Lansing Diocese by 24 years. That was in 1937. When the cathedral was consecrated on December 8, 1913, the building was completely debt-free due to the donations of Catholics and non-Catholics alike. Now on Monday, the diocese is holding a special ceremony to recognize St. Mary's history and legacy. I took a tour a couple of days ago of the cathedral with Monsignor George McCulloch. He has been the official diocesan historian for the last 34 years, so as you can imagine, he knows every brick and candle in the building. The first fact that I learned is that St. Mary's technically is not the cathedral's real name.
The official name is the Cathedral of the Immaculate Conception because it was consecrated on December 8, 1913 to the Blessed Virgin Mary of the Immaculate Conception. They called it St. Mary's Parish, and St. Mary's is always stuck. It's easier to answer the phone that way, too.
What can you tell us about when this beautiful structure was dedicated?
In 1910, they began excavating, and in 1911, on the 4th of July, they laid the cornerstone. We did it on the 4th of July because there was a lot of anti-Catholic sentiment at that point, that you couldn't be a good Catholic and still be a good American because you had this allegiance to a foreign power, the Pope. So we did everything on the 4th of July with plenty of flags, proving that we could be good Catholics and good Americans at the same time. And I interviewed a priest who later became pastor here, and he was a son of this parish, and he was a server at the cornerstone laying in 1911. And he said that whatever orator they brought in some you know, famous priest. You could hear him for 2 miles away. I think he exaggerated. It's probably more like 2 blocks. The gentleman was in his 80s when I interviewed him. So
the story gets embellished over time.
Yeah, it gets better, you know, with every retelling.
Well, right now we are on the main floor of the cathedral in what is loosely called the mini museum, and there are stained glass depictions of the life of Christ here, but there's also many photographs here. There's a table in front of us with a lot of black and white photographs. Any of these particularly significant?
Well, the one here that shows the rose window, the framework of the rose window being elevated above the main door, that was taken probably in 1912 sometime. You also see somehow they had some kind of steam-motivated hoist that they were using to move things up. And you see a lot of people pointing their fingers up that it's got to clear the top of the door. And then this is summer of 1913 when they're still working on the towers. And the style of the church is Norman Gothic. And many of the great Gothic cathedrals have towers that are of varying heights, not the same. And the priest who was the pastor here at the time, speaking of Norman Gothic, was Father Lafayette Isidore Branchot, French-Canadian, obviously. Born in Monroe, big French community. 18 members of his family are going to be here Monday night for the concluding Mass.
There are a few people in the church who are praying, so maybe we should be as quiet as possible, as church mice, as it were. Is there possibly a way to see some of these architectural examples?
Certainly.
This building is in very good shape for 100 years.
Yes. It takes a lot of upkeep, And obviously it needs a new paint job, but it also needs other things first, like rewiring so that we could put in air conditioning. And
there's no air conditioning in this church?
No. Well, there is some in the sanctuary. So that's an incentive to sit up close to the front, which is un-Catholic. I always fill in from the back. This is the nativity window, the great window of the cathedral. And it has on the left-hand side the three kings, on the right-hand side the shepherds. And way up in the window are the golden-winged cherubim singing. These windows on the upper level and the life of Mary, these five windows, and the water windows in the baptistry all came from Munich, Germany, we think from the studio of Franz Mayer. Unfortunately, we lost records in 1938. We had a fire in the rectory. Almost killed off the bishop. He had to be taken to the hospital for a week from smoke inhalation. The first bishop was an army chaplain in World War I and gassed in the trenches and didn't have a lot of lung strength. So he was easily overcome and had to be hospitalized. But because of the water damage, we lost the records of when the windows were actually purchased in the mid-20s or early 20s. We do know that these smaller windows, the Life of Mary and the water windows, each cost $100 a piece when they were installed.
Again, in the 1920s.
Yes, in the 1920s. The windows are evaluated at well over $1.5 million now.
Do I understand correctly, Monsignor, that there are also relics in this church?
Yes, there are relics that were in the original 1913 altar. And because an altar has to have a relic of a martyr, because that's where the tradition came from of having relics in an altar, that they celebrated the sacrifice of the Mass over the bones of the martyrs in the catacombs in Rome. So we have a relic of Lawrence the Deacon. We also have a relic of St. Dominic. And we have a relic of St. Barbara. In the original 1913 church, there were three steps up to a sedalia level, which was where the priest sat, and then there were another three steps up to the altar level where we're at now. And in this 1967 renovation, they put another set of steps up to the bishop's chair, and no one's to sit in that except the bishop except when little kids come in and run up there and sit down. So
that's where I was going, and you got me there. You've already got it.
It happens all the time. But no one else is supposed to sit there. The priests can't sit there. They have to sit other chairs because that is the seat of the bishop, and he teaches, governs, and guides us.
Do these emblems mean that much to the everyday Catholic?
Probably not, but they're rich symbols if they would think about them. I always said you should never be bored in a Catholic church because there's always something to study, whether it's the windows or the coat of arms or whatever. There's something to contemplate because there's rich tradition.
Monsignor, Monday there will be a celebration of the church's centennial here. What will happen on Monday and when?
Well, there'll be a mass at 6 p.m. and Bishop Boyer will be the celebrant and the homilist, and Bishop Mengling will be here, the former bishop of Lansing. And it'll be a wonderful liturgy. The cathedral choir will perform the music. And the prelude music is pieces that would have been sung by the choir in 1913 by composers. And one of the pieces, the Schubert Ave Maria, was done during the 1913 celebration.
Monsignor George McCulloch is the diocesan historian and archivist for the Catholic Diocese of Lansing. Monsignor, thank you for this great tour of St. Mary Cathedral and happy centennial anniversary.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. God bless you.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
Several times today on the program, you've heard some wonderfully expressive music, different music from what you just heard, but it was jazz, courtesy of Molly McFadden, who is a vocalist, and pianist Mike Brush, who have provided the music here live this morning on Studio S. And we welcome Molly and Mike to the microphones now.
Hi, thank you.
We've really enjoyed your performance today. Tell us, Molly, you are part of an organization. You're the founder of an organization called the Michigan Jazz Trail.
Yes.
What are you trying to get done?
I moved here 15 years ago, Mark, from New York, and I was astounded in this state, all the fabulous musicians, all the fabulous jazz players. You know, I would bump into concerts here in Lansing, as a matter of fact, or Ann Arbor, or up in Sutton's Bay, and I said, this state is rich with musicians and music and jazz. Well, I had my bistro, Molly's Bistro, and again, I was impressed with all the musicians that would come through the bistro, Mike Brush being one of them, with a wonderful vocalist, Julie Mullady. I said, you know, we got to do something here. Mm. Well, I went to New York. I performed with a trio, and everyone in New York said, wow, you are playing with some really great musicians. I said, yes, they're from Michigan. So this idea grew, and I said, we have got to find a way. This was during the economic downturn. Michigan was, you know, struggling.
I remember that.
I do, too. We all do, right? And I said, well, if Mississippi can have the Mississippi Blues Trail, why couldn't Michigan have the Michigan Jazz Trail?
Ah, interesting.
And that's how I connected it. So I met with Mr. Zimmerman of Pure Michigan, and anybody who would hear my spiel, anybody who would hear me, I said, we have got to create a map. And we could start on Memorial Weekend in Lansing or Ann Arbor and go up and down the state across and end up in Detroit on Labor Day. And people could plan their vacations, you know, with golf and water. But be aware of all of the festivals that we have throughout the state.
So is that taking shape? Are you?
It's slowly taking shape. I've succeeded with the Great Lakes Bay region. What we have now, we have a 19-member big band made up of consummate musicians such as Mike Brush, Jeff Hall, Dan Jacobs, Robbie Smith, to name just a few, plus many more. And we perform in Midland, Freeland, Bay City, Saginaw. Next summer, we're going to be up in Charlevoix and Boyne City. So this big band is touring the state, celebrating the music, and saying, come on, join the bandwagon. Hopefully, other jazz festivals we can all organize together and have a website all together so we don't have to work so hard. to market what it is we're doing.
So you're trying to map out, you're literally mapping out the Michigan Jazz Trail.
Absolutely.
Right now.
Absolutely, okay. And that's why I was thrilled when we could come on your program and share what we're trying to do, what the vision is and
well,
the mission.
Full disclosure, I mean, I have caught Molly's act a couple of times. This was quite serendipitous that you should join us today because several times, I've got a relative, my sister lives in Midland and we went to Molly's Bistro. I'm sorry to hear it's no longer operating, but we caught your act several times and enjoyed it immensely in downtown Midland. Mike Brush, what's your take on the Michigan Jazz Sing?
It's an exciting idea. The concept is exciting. It's inclusive of as many musicians that fit into that format as we can find.
Yeah.
And you are bringing no less than Wynton Marsalis to perform at the Temple Theater in Saginaw this Sunday. Tell us about that.
5 years ago, I said what I would love is for this big band to perform with international jazz musicians. So we did with Kevin Cole, Michigander. What a wonderful musician. Not particularly jazz, but Gershwin. Following year, we had John Pizzarelli. Following year, we had Ramsey Lewis. And I always wanted Wynton Marsalis because he's premier.
He's top drawer. Yeah.
So when I talked to the agent and working with the agent, I said, now, will Mr. Marsalis and the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra, will they be okay if the Michigan Jazz Trail Big Band opens for them? He said, absolutely. In fact, Wynton loves what you're doing. We also work with students. We also highlight students at these venues. And in February, we're going to do an all-inclusive workshop for jazz bands in high school. Michigan Jazz Trail Big Band will play some of their charts so they can hear it live and mix it up.
Very exciting.
Yeah.
And you're also going to help us. You and I, the Michigan Jazz Trail and Current State, are both talking about regular jazz on our program, thanks to you.
Yes.
So we're very excited about that.
Oh, good.
So, we want to hear you perform one more time. So we will tell us about what you're going to play here. Play us out on.
Well, we'll end on a little bit of Gershwin, and it's wonderful. In fact, when I first arrived in New York 20 years ago, it was the first song I ever auditioned with a jazz band. So I have a special place in my heart for it.
That's fantastic. Yep. I'm sure it's going to be a great performance. Molly McFadden and Mike Brush, will let them make their way back to the microphone so they can play us out with Gershwin's Swonderful. And once again, Wynton Marsalis to perform at the Temple Theater with a number of Michigan Jazz Trail musicians this Sunday night. If you're not aware of that, that's worth the drive. Wynton Marsalis. So with that as a prelude, let's go to Molly and Mike. Molly McFadden and Mike Brush.
Wonderful, marvelous, you, my baby, should care for me. Awful night. Paradise, what I love to see. Well, now you've made my life so glamorous. You can't blame me for feeling amorous. Marvelous that you should care for me.
Singer Molly McFadden, pianist Mike Brush of the Michigan Jazz Trail. That's our show for today. We're pleased you could join us. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State on WKAR.
That you should care for me. You've made my life so glamorous that you can't blame me for feeling amorous.
marvelous that you should care for, that you should care for, that you should care for me.